In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of France and how it is that it came to be the place that we think about today, and in fact, how the very idea of France as a nation came about. And our guest is Graham Robb, who is the author of a newly published book, a very interesting book, which is titled The Discovery of France, an Historical Geography from the Revolution to the First World War. By about the time of 1890, France had been established as the cultural center of Europe. However, there were perhaps, in a sense, two kind of Frances at this point. It was the place that existed in the city of Paris, and then there was the rest of the country, a land that at that time, at that late date, still was a place of ancient tribal divisions, prehistoric communication networks, and in some cases, pre-Christian beliefs. In this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about how modern France came to be, and in fact, how poorly understood it may indeed remain to this very day. And that is what the book is all about, The Discovery of France. Our guest, Graham Robb, has published widely in French literature and history. He's authored biographies of Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Rimbaud, and those have won critical acclaim. They were all selected as New York Times choices for best books of the year. He makes his home in Oxford, in England. The book is out just recently, published by W.W. Norton, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Mr. Robb, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
And perhaps I should mention that we should mention up front here that in the course of doing this book and your exploring France, you did at one point understand that you had to spend a lot of time doing research, and you spent it in the library, but that you also spent a lot of time bicycling around the country. I think that the figure that I've seen is something like 14,000 miles you traveled by bicycle around France.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I didn't do it all in one go. That was over a period of about 10 years. And really, that's how the book began. I didn't realize I was going to write a history of France. It's just that my wife's American, and both of us cycle all the time anyway, and France is probably the best country in the world in which to cycle. So we always, whenever we could, went to France to cycle. And it just created, cycling creates an enormous appetite for local food, but also creates an appetite for information. So that's how the book began. It was just to satisfy my own curiosity about what I was actually seeing from the saddle.
Well, and I expect that having known a lot about and written a lot about France and French culture, that at some point that you thought to yourself, well, you know, I know this country pretty well. Was there then, though, something in particular that happened or that you came across where you realized that, in fact, there was a lot more to be known and more to be learned, and that for you, as much as you knew about France, that there was a lot of unexplored territory, both figuratively and literally?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I did, you know, I was supposed to know about France. I had a degree in French literature. But once I got to know France a little bit better, I realized that my degree was really in Parisian literature and that most of the history I knew was Parisian history. So I think the first time really was when we were living in Brittany and also Provence in the same year. And when we lived in Brittany, the people who lived next door to us did not speak French as their first language. They spoke Breton. And in Provence, our neighbors did not speak French as their first language. They spoke Provençal. And I think that's when I began to realize that even though I knew French and thought I knew French history, there was really quite a lot more to be known about it. And once I read the histories, I read guidebooks, but I really didn't find anything that could tell me why all these little regions were so different from each other.
And this is indeed the story here, that until relatively recently, a lot of the people of France lived in rural areas. They lived in small communities, many of them. I'm sure that there certainly would have been a time when most people lived out their entire lives in the place that they were born.
Yeah.
And that French as a language was not widely spoken outside of a relatively small territory, perhaps centered on Paris, or at least maybe the northern half of the country. And yeah. and that, in fact, as you say, that for a lot of people, there would have been a time, maybe even within the last century, where French would have been a foreign language.
That's right, yeah. French itself was a minority language in France until just over 100 years ago. And no one in Paris really knew this until the revolution came along in 1789, and they realized that since it was now supposed to be a democracy, everyone ought to understand what the government was doing. So they sent out their decrees, and that's how they found out that no one could understand them, because they were all printed and published in French. And a man called the Abbé Grégoire sent out questionnaires to different parts of the country and all the remote provinces, asking, what language do people speak in your region? And when the answers came back in, he was horrified to see that relatively few people spoke French in France, and that the country was effectively unknown to Paris. Paris was like the almost like Rome in the Roman Empire. You know, the Parisian Empire had not yet extended across the rest of the country.
It's so remarkable, really, when you read some of this story about, and you read about all of the various very distinct groups of people living in particular kind of ways with particular traditions and speaking their own local language. You certainly wonder, are there particular conditions that foster that kind of extreme regionalism or provincialism, I guess? I don't mean to say that in a negative way, but it's something about, and it may be that the same kind of thing plays out in other places, but how it is that not only do you end up with a place that has a distinct kind of national feeling, but on this very, very local level, how it is you had these apparently very stable, very small communities with their own very distinct ways of doing things.
Yeah, and as you say, these little tiny communities are incredibly stable. They're referred to in France as pays, which is usually translated as country, but it really means home territory. And it comes from the Latin pagus, from which we get pagan, which meant the area that was controlled by a particular tribe. And a lot of these places could trace themselves way back before the Romans invaded Gaul. And, you know, why were they so stable? And it's partly because France is a land of great geographical extremes. You have two big mountain ranges, Pyrenees in the south, the Alps in the east, and a big plateau in the center, the navel of the country, called the Massif Central, mm-hmm. which remain quite inaccessible, really. Very few people went to the Massif Central, which is a vast area in the center of France. I mean, even Napoleon Bonaparte, who went everywhere, he avoided it. And even the Tour de France bicycle race later on didn't go to it until the 1950s. So it was partly that that enabled these little places to survive as independent states. And some of them effectively were independent states and didn't even necessarily know that there was a king hundreds of miles away in Paris who was supposed to be their leader.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you can, as you say, you can understand because the country itself has some of these formidable national boundaries that frame it, where, so you could see the division between, you know, France and Germany or France and Spain, but you still, and certainly there are some internal features that have that same sort of function, but I still find myself wondering, you know, I'm sure that there are places where you had one community and then 10 miles away you had another one, and it was like going to another country. Or if people went at all, and chances were they probably didn't go that much. They didn't drop by whoever the next door neighbor was, even if they might have only been 10 miles away.
Yeah, that's right. Because very often, if you moved 10 miles from where you lived, you would start to become incomprehensible to other people because the dialects and sub-dialects were so diverse find yourself in a different, the area of a different language group just by crossing a river or crossing the local mountain. So, and most people really didn't move much more than 5 miles from their place of birth. It sounds incredible these days. You wonder how a population could survive for so long. But anthropologists have shown that the human race can withstand a lot of inbreeding. And you really do need quite a small population for a particular place to survive. So I think that the extent to which France was divided up into these tiny little pays was a shock to people once they started to go out and find out what was there in the rest of the country at the end of the 18th century.
So even on the eve of the revolution, 1789, if we got together a group of people and we got someone from Brittany and someone from Alsace and someone who was a Gascon and someone from Provence, and we brought them all together and put them together, they would not be able to talk to one another.
They would have some slight understanding. I mean, in Brittany, Breton is a Celtic language, so it's a completely different language group. And until quite recently, some people from Brittany who sailed to Wales, for example, or Cornwall before the Cornish language died out, could make themselves understood there better than they could in the rest of France. And what some travelers found was that as they passed through France and passed through these different linguistic regions, the best language to use was Latin. And that almost all those centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire, Latin was still being used as a kind of lingua franca.
Would it be correct to say, do you think, that at that point that we're talking about, so at about 1800 or again around the time of the French Revolution, that for many people they would have still been, in many important ways, they would have still been living the way that they had lived for hundreds of years, maybe more, maybe at least going back to the Middle Ages, that they would have more in common with their great-great-grandparents than they would with people as they live today?
That's correct, yeah. Some people who went out to explore France were quite excited to see that people were still using a prehistoric kind of plow, for example. That people didn't wear shoes, didn't have windows, that they didn't leave their place of birth, and also sometimes that they seemed to hibernate in the winter. They would just stay in bed for 6 months of the year to save resources. Mm. So, it's true that what most people were interested in was surviving, not in economic development.
And I suppose that, again, one of the reasons that people didn't travel or didn't leave their place very much is that I'm sure that there was a very real chance that if people got too far away, they'd get lost. And one of the interesting parts of the story is that until relatively recently, the country was not completely mapped. You couldn't, if you decided that you were going to travel, you couldn't have, as we can today, you can't go down to the bookstore or go down to wherever and get a map of the country. Such a thing just didn't exist.
Yeah, that's right. There was no map until, after the fall of Napoleon. They started making a map of the whole country in about 1740, and it took 65 years to publish the whole map. And this was a huge expedition. And this was really the first time that anyone had tried to show what lay on either side of the roads. Until then, there were just these narrow corridors of transit that crossed the country. But really very few roads even then. A lot of so-called roads weren't really recognizable as roads at all. They were just tracks. And a track that was there in summer wouldn't be there in winter. So, as you say, there was nothing to tell you exactly where things were. They had to start completely from scratch.
Our guest in this hour is Graham Robb. The book is The Discovery of France, an historical geography from the Revolution to the First World War. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-9455. 1-800-222-9455. I think another interesting feature of this story is that apparently for a lot of this time that we're talking about, there was a lot of territory, a lot of France was actually not inhabited. There weren't anybody living there. Do we know what the population of France at the time of the French Revolution was?
Yeah, it's hard to tell exactly, but say about 30 million. But censuses were very unreliable because they didn't cover all parts of France. But, it was about, as today, the population of France is about the same as the population of the United Kingdom, but France is 2.5 times bigger than Britain. So there were large parts of France that were uninhabited, or that were inhabited only by nomadic people who were there for any part of the year.
Tell us about just the one of the really interesting things about this story is it's a kind of ethnography listing different kinds of people living different places, again with very different sorts of ways of making a living and living in different cultures. What give us some sense of what the cultural diversity of the country would have been, again, at the time that we're talking about. Basically, we're going back a couple of hundred years.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about writing this book is that the country is so diverse that it's very difficult to generalize. But one thing that was discovered shortly after the revolution is that there's a kind of fault line that goes across the middle of France, which divides the southern sort of Mediterranean civilization from the northern civilization. And the division is not just linguistic. There's the Occitan languages like Provençal, which are spoken south of the line, and then the so-called Ouïe languages, from the word for yes, oui, to the north of the line, which includes the dialect we now call French. But there was also a division between domestic architecture, the roofs would have a different slope, the kind of agriculture that's practiced. So I think that the main, one of the ways in which people tried to make sense of this diversity was to show that there was the Mediterranean civilization, which had survived since the Romans, and then the barbarian civilization north of the line. But then, of course, on the perimeter of France, you had all these other little civilizations, the Basques and the Bretons, that were probably even older than the Gaulish civilizations that the Romans had discovered.
When you talked about the fact that at the point of the revolution, some persons got this idea that, well, we're all going to be one nation now, and if we're all going to be one nation, we're all going to speak the same language, and someone went out, and then they were shocked to realize that, in fact, they were an enormous number of, at least, if not different language, distinct languages, distinct dialects that were spoken all around the country. Assuming that someone decided to engineer a one-language kind of policy for the country, how did they even go about trying to do that, or was that something that really, until we had an age of mass communications, simply just would not have been possible?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that when we think of the French Revolution, you think of blood in streets and violence and sort of institutional terrorism. But actually, at the Revolution, they didn't really try to impose French as the single language. It was more a gentle encouragement, the hope that people would want to learn French so that they could be citizens of the indivisible republic. And it was much later, end of the 19th century, even 20th century, you can still find people today who remember this, that the school teachers of what was then the Third Republic were instructed to punish children who used any patois dialect word at school. And they were persecuted for being non-French speakers. And the interesting thing about that is that it didn't really work. It just made people miserable, or it made people despise their parents for being peasants who only knew the patois. So as usual, it was only with trade and economic development and curiosity about what was going on in the bigger towns and cities that eventually began to impose French as the language of France. But it took a very long time. And even today, you can hear people speaking languages other than French in many parts of France. And there are probably far more speakers than are known about because, for some reason, people tend not to report this when they're asked in censuses. They'll say, I'm a French speaker, or I speak a dialect of French. And they don't always realize that what they're speaking is a different language or a different dialect.
Even today, I guess I've picked up some of this from some of the reviews of the book that I've read. It sounds as if, I know we're sort of bouncing around here, but it sounds as if even today, in many places around France, even if you go to Paris, where you will meet people who weren't born in Paris but came from elsewhere, there is still a very strong sense of identity. And perhaps also it's either identity tied to culture, identity tied to the place that they were born.
Yeah.
And so that there's still this very strong, you know, people have this really strong sense of mixed identities or blended identities, or, you know, how in this country we like to hyphenate. We call them, you know, something Americans. That it seems that yet still in France today there is this very strong sense of identity that people have as being distinct and not lost in this whole mass of Frenchness, but they definitely are tied to place and tradition.
They are very tied to what they call their pays, and quite often someone who lives in Paris and, say, works in business will have a little house in their part of the country where they came from. And sometimes they'll commute at the weekend, what in European terms are great distances, just to dig the native soil and to pull up a few vegetables that have grown in what they call the terroir, vegetables that will have the particular taste and flavor of their homeland. And as you say, people are still very attached to not even necessarily the place they were born, the place where their parents and grandparents came from. In Paris, they say, if you're a real Parisian, you're said to be a Parisien de Paris, to distinguish you from all the other people who aren't really Parisians.
Mm. The one thing that people certainly would have had in common would be religion, at least in the sense that everyone would have been Roman Catholic. Would there have been, though, great differences in practice, again, as in the time that we're talking about, as recently as a couple of hundred years ago?
Yes, there certainly would be, and not even a couple of hundred years ago. The official story is that Gaul had been Christianized by the 6th century. But what the church found, not only in the 6th century, but even in the early 20th century, was that this Christianization was very superficial, and that under the guise of Christianity, people were still practicing what seemed to be pagan beliefs that had never died out. And for example, prehistoric stones, which you find throughout France, and in some parts more than others, were still objects of veneration. People would go and talk to the stones, ask their advice, leave offerings at the foot of them. And the church was quite canny. They did not usually try to eradicate these pagan beliefs. They would, for example, carve one of these prehistoric stones into the shape of a Christian cross. And you can still see them today in several parts of France, the kind of weird, tall stone crosses. And in Brittany, they found that the best thing to do was to find a saint who was the closest equivalent to the local deity or the local fairies. And that's why in Brittany, St. Anne is the patron saint, and lots of churches all over Brittany dedicated to St. Anne. And this is because Anna was a Celtic word for swamp or pond, which were thought to be sacred, holy places. So they would just say, okay, well, we'll call this St. Anne then instead of Anna. And that way, at least if they pray, their prayers will be redirected in the right direction.
That certainly would not be the first place that Christians came along and grafted Christian beliefs on top of pagan, native, local pagan sites and deities and so forth. I feel that we've seen that repeated again and again and again all over the place. Let me just introduce very quickly our guest, Graham Robb. He's published widely in French literature and history. He's authored biographies of Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Rambo, and they've won a lot of critical acclaim. They were selected as New York Times choices for best books of the year when they came out. And he has a new book that is titled The Discovery of France, an historical geography from the Revolution to the First World War. It's published by W.W. Norton, and it's the result of quite a number of years of both research and travel in France. And as he explained at the outset, there would have been a time when he would have thought he knew France pretty well, but then came to realize that, in fact, there were a lot of things about France that perhaps he didn't know, and just how fascinating it was to go back not that far in history and realize just how diverse a place that it was, where, for example, French would have been a minority language, and that people would have had very, very strong identifications with the places where they lived. And that's the way they thought of themselves, not so much as being French, but being a person of the local place where they were born and grew up, and in a lot of cases where they died. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you talked about the fact that, you know, for a long time, a lot of people, certainly people in France, didn't travel. It just wasn't really done. It would have been difficult in some cases. There weren't maps, so people couldn't do that. So probably maybe some of the first people who really traveled extensively in France weren't French at all. They were tourists. They were British. They were American who came there. And I'm interested in having you talk about how tourism, and particularly outsiders come and traveling around the country, actually helps to, perhaps in some cases, to create French, quote-unquote, French culture, what we now think of as being French culture.
Yeah, that's right. It's I guess the dawn of tourism in France was an expedition of English gentlemen led by a man called William Boxing Windham, because he was a great boxer, who set out from Geneva to visit the glaciers around Chamonix. And they were the first outsiders, really, to enter this unknown place. And the people who lived in Chamonix were already well-traveled. They were migrant workers and peddlers. Some of them had been to Paris. So one day they saw this party of English gentlemen with their guides and guards armed to the teeth, struggling up their valley to visit their remote and primitive settlement. And they thought this was absolutely hilarious. They camped outside the village, kept the fires burning all night long in case they were attacked by savage people. And that's really the start of tourism in France. And as you say, it was mostly British and American tourists who were going there. And people wondered, why has someone come to look at these barren mountains? And to them, it was just useless land. It was a wasteland that happened to be vertical instead of horizontal. Mm. And when they saw them traveling all that way to see what they thought of as beautiful sights, they began to look at their homeland in a different way. And as you say, there is kind of local patriotism that grew out of this. They realized that maybe they lived in a beautiful region, and also that the beauties of their region could be an economic resource.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who is listening this morning in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Two comments. One is the Christianization of the megaliths is very interesting. I've written on the megaliths and have a number of publications in that area. And when I was over in England, I've stayed with Aubrey Burrell, who has written extensively on the same thing. And he took me up to a megalithic site in England where there was a church. And he claimed that a lot of the people there would when Christianity entered that region, would go to a place where there was a megalith and build a church. And the reason he gave was that these people would look for places that were that was sacred ground. And so there was a kind of a blending of the megalithic culture and Christianity. And so in France, they would take a lot of those megaliths and carve them into Christian icons. The other comment I would make about the language, when I was on sabbatical, I traveled through Europe, and when I went to France for the first time, I was taking a train from Paris down to southern France, and I'd hear somebody talk French, and I'd turn around thinking they were American. But yet they were speaking French. But when I was in England, I could understand the language, but my ear was not picking up the American dialect. If you understand what I'm saying, it was like listening to Frisian for the first time. For the first time I heard Frisian, I thought that those people were speaking English or American. And yet, I couldn't understand a word they said. And I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Well, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, that's it's true that the Christianization of megalithic sites happened all over Europe, really, and in France. There's still some good examples of the church that replaced the earlier site at Lens, for example, or Le Mans, actually. There's still a large, odd-shaped stone that leans against the cathedral and looks very odd against the Gothic architecture. And this was a prehistoric stone that the church was going to remove, and the people rioted. They wouldn't allow the stone to be taken away. So it's still there, leaning against the church. And even more interestingly, some of these prehistoric sites, or perhaps not prehistoric sites, are still religious sites. There's a place in a forest in Brittany called the Tomb of Merlin, which was probably decided in the 19th century it was the Tomb of Merlin. But if you go there now, you see flowers and votive offerings and prayers very often written on pieces of paper. And when I was there a couple of years ago, one of the pieces of paper was open, and it said, "Dear Merlin, you have made me happy. Please teach me some magic tricks so I can make other people happy too." So it's still going on today.
Mm. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess I also wouldn't want to make it sound as if, say, prior to the revolution or prior to the growth of tourism, that French people didn't, there weren't, no one traveled. I mean, there were indeed people who moved around the country. People went on pilgrimages. There were itinerant peddlers, people who had some product that they took from one place to another to try to sell it. So certainly there were people who did go from the provinces to Paris and back. What sort of impact did they have, people who did indeed travel, who were internal migrants in a sense, who did go from one place to another?
They had a huge effect, because really until there was a proper road system, that was the only way that news spread about the country. And even though the main roads were almost empty, even on the busiest roads in France, you would rarely see more than 10 vehicles go past in an hour. There was this vast capillary system of little tracks and byways that was used by these long-distance peddlers and migrant laborers. So they're really the first people who began to bring the country together just by using this network of little tracks. And it's the only way in which to explain that news of important events spread so quickly when there was really no communications network, even before the telegraph and a long time before the railways, that just by passing news from mouth to mouth, it could reach remote parts of the country at amazing speed.
How did, you know, given the fact that most people were indeed living in small rural communities and the central government was not particularly a presence in their lives, and in fact probably a lot of people thought they would just as soon not have anything to do with the government, that it was a force that was not particularly a force of good, but that if anything, that it was that one way or another it meant trouble, that the government meant trouble. Having said all that, how did was there law enforcement? How did people deal with law breaking? Because certainly there was what we would call criminal behavior, even if there wasn't maybe a formalized set of laws.
Yeah.
How did people deal with that?
Well, as you say, there certainly was criminal behavior, and there were even wars and battles between rival villages where people were killed. And yet, when you look at the criminal records for the different départements of France, some of them seem to have had no crime whatsoever. Sometimes there were so-called white assizes when a court sat and heard no cases. And what happened in practice was that each little region had its own informal courts of justice, and cases would be tried by the community according to some ancient set of laws that probably dated back to before the Romans. So they were quite efficient at policing themselves, although, of course, it meant the regime could be very brutal. If anyone was in any way unusual, if they were, say, homosexual, or if they looked strange, or they had a frightening disability, they might suffer at the hands of this village justice. And even though it could be brutal, as you say, once the state began to interfere, this was felt to be an intolerable intrusion. Because, you know, where did these laws come from, and why should they be applied to my little village?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there were a number of things that, when they came along, started to change life dramatically and bring about some greater sense of nationalism and nationhood. And so we get into the times when the country is being mapped, where transportation gets improved so it's easier to travel. You do have some kind of method of mass communication so that in a relatively short period of time, you can get word of something from one end of the country to the other. But I guess on that point, though, I gather that in anybody's book, the first real important piece of news that was, let's say, nationally disseminated, if you want to put some kind of date on the coming of mass communications and the ability to put out some kind of story across the country, that's not until World War One. It was the outbreak of World War One that was sort of the benchmark for being able to, in a sense, broadcast some piece of news and essentially get it out to everybody.
Yes, that's really the first time that a piece of news reached the whole country on the same day. And even then, it came as a complete surprise to many people. They had no idea about the international political situation, and they didn't know why they suddenly had to leave home. But as you say, that is the first time that everyone found out on the same day about something of national importance.
Of all of these various things, developments that came to start to pull this nation together, was there some particular important turning point, or did one of them end up being any more important than anything else?
I think probably it was the First World War, just because it brought a lot of people together who wouldn't have met otherwise. And this was quite a shattering experience, of course, and apart from the horror of the war itself. There are several tales of Breton soldiers from Brittany who, obviously speaking their native tongue, Breton, were mistaken by other French soldiers for Germans and shot. And so I think, you know, the First World War probably is the big turning point. But one of the things I found while writing the book was that whenever you think you've found the point at which France became a modern nation, You can find examples much later of isolation and the sort of France that had existed before the revolution still continuing. Mm. Even today, it's still a largely rural country, which explains why French presidents usually have to show that they know how to behave with sheep and cows and how to milk a goat and so on.
Well, it probably doesn't hurt an American president to be able to they put on that kind of show. I mean, you know, right now we have candidates are out in Iowa. They've been spending time there. So I suppose you have to at least put on a good show that you know what being a farmer is all about. I don't know if they actually have to do any milking, but it would not surprise me if such a thing would have to happen. Again, going back to tourism, I think it's interesting that we talked about how there was a certain point where tourists started to come, and particularly a lot of people came from Britain and from the United States, and that in some cases initially the locals were amused or bemused or confused that these people had shown up and had come all this way to look at their mountain when they thought, well, what's the big deal? You know, we've been living with this mountain forever. Yeah, it's a mountain, so whatever. And so then it started them thinking, well, gosh, yeah, actually, this is not such a bad place where we live, and maybe we can understand why people would want to come to look at it. I'm interested in this idea, though, that maybe some of what we think about as French culture, or maybe it's what we're thinking about really as Parisian culture, was something that was created for tourists. It was something that was actually made for tourists. And so that, you know, perhaps now it is actually established and is really considered to be part of French culture. But you wonder if it hadn't been for the tourist trade, whether some of those things would have existed at all.
Yeah, the French government did a great job of recreating France as a tourist destination. And the line they took was that if you're a true Frenchman and a true patriot, instead of going to Italy or Spain or Switzerland, you will go on holiday in France and enjoy the wonders of your own country. And this was about the turn of the century, about, say, late 19th century, early 20th century, when they started to rename parts of France. So the Mediterranean coastline, not all of which is very picturesque, was renamed the Côte d'Azur, as it's still known today. And it's also the period when people started to say the land least known in France is France itself. And that's what people still say today. And you can still see signs of this great drive to send French citizens out to the remote and picturesque parts of their own country. You still see old touring Club de France signs in what now appear to be rather dilapidated and not very interesting parts of the country.
Is there something, good example that comes to mind of a place that today is still very unchanged from the way that it would have been hundreds of years ago?
Yeah, there's one. There's one place in the Pyrenees that I was very curious to see because it's just at the end of a track. Quite a long way up a track. And I'd seen a photograph of this in a book that was published by an American tourist in the 1890s. And in fact, the place isn't even on most maps. You have to get a very detailed map to show it. And so we cycled up there and pushed our bikes past the way. And then eventually looked down into this valley and saw it exactly as it was in the picture, no bigger. And there were two women in front of one of the houses, just as they had been in the picture. And they turned out to be relatives of the people in the picture, in the book that I'd seen. And I showed them the picture. She said, oh, yes, that would be my great-grandmother. And they'd been living there all along, and very, very simply indeed. They just have a few animals, and they hardly leave the place at all. I mean, of course, they know about the outside world now. That's a big difference. But that it's still unchanged. You know, there's very little that's new there at all.
Hmm. Well, just to come back to maybe the point where we started, to talk a little bit about the idea of French nationalism and to what extent people think of themselves as French in addition to perhaps some other kinds of identities that you know, that tie them to the home place. How do people think about that, and does one or the other of those things come first? And is there actually a strong, do people have a strong sense of being French? And if so, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I think, as you said earlier on, the big division is still between Parisian and provincial, rather than between urban and rural. And so I think, you know, people do think of themselves as French, but they think of themselves first and foremost as Burgundian or Gascon or Norman or Breton. But I think these days, you know, most people would identify themselves as French. What happens now is that very often newspapers will identify someone as a French citizen of Algerian origin or French citizen of Moroccan origin. And so even though they are French citizens, it's very often what you might call official sources or even government, even politicians, will identify groups of the population as being French, but not really French to the same extent as other French citizens.
Hmm. We're coming down on time here. We have a couple of minutes left. We have a caller, sir. I want to try to squeeze them in here. Someone in our area, our line number one. Hello.
What are the three areas? Aquitania is one, and Gaul proper, but could you discuss the boundaries and say something about Corsica? Okay.
Yeah. Well, Corsica, of course, was the home of Napoleon Bonaparte. And, I mean, it's not just Aquitania. And, you know, Caesar said that Gaul was divided into three parts, but that's a great underestimation. Corsica was one of the parts of what we now call France, that was brought in at a relatively recent date. In fact, parts were still being added to France in the 1860s. So, you know, the boundaries changed quite a lot. Some of the provinces, like Aquitania, survived for centuries. But, you know, France, as it's now composed, with its modern boundaries, is a younger nation than the United States.
Just as a way of finishing in the last maybe minute or two we have here, certainly France and other countries in Europe are too, and well, for that matter, so is the United States. They're struggling with how to accommodate newcomers and what they think that means, and you know, struggling about, well, do we have some sort of set of national values, and how do we communicate those, and do we expect people to embrace them, and is that ever unchanging, or does that somehow change as we bring new people in with some kind of different traditions? And it's a very difficult thing that people are wrestling with all over, and it seems particularly acute in France, or at least we have seen a lot of unrest that seems prompted by these very, very kinds of discussions. And, of course, now we have a French president who had in the past said very tough things about yeah, these very people, Mr. Sarkozy. How are French people wrestling with that, this very, you know, given the fact that the French are maybe even a little ambivalent about their own identity, how they're wrestling with this identity question?
Yeah, I think, from the French North Africans I knew when I worked in Paris, years and years ago, washing trucks. I know that section of the population is not well treated at all, and that there is a lot of institutional racism, especially in the police force. And one of the disastrous things that President Sarkozy has done is to remove the local policemen who know those areas in the suburbs of Paris and to replace them with the CRS, the French riot police. And he gained a lot of support from voters for saying insulting things about people who live in those suburbs. So it's curious that, you know, those people consider themselves to be French, but they have the unmistaken impression that part of the French state doesn't consider them to be French, and a lot of them have been French for several generations now. So that's a very, very tricky situation. It goes back a long way through French history. It's not just a recent development.
Well, I think that we're at the point we're going to have to finish up because we've come to the end of the conversation, but there's a lot of very interesting things in this book, and I certainly will recommend it to people who are listening. The book is The Discovery of France, an Historical Geography from the Revolution to the First World War. It is published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Graham Robb. It's published widely in both French literature and history and has authored biographies of Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Rimbaud that were all critically acclaimed, and he makes his home in Oxford, England. And Mr. Robb, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.